This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. So excited that you're joining me today. We've got a super show, really interesting take on things. We're going to be talking to Dr. Philip Schott, DVM, about his latest book, Heal the Beasts, A Jaunt Through the Curious History of the Veterinarian Arts. So it's a fascinating tale, fascinating insight to days gone by, all kinds of unique things that we probably look back on now and treating animals that we think, what were they thinking? And other ones get you to think, that's interesting. So a lot of good intakes and insights going through a history of veterinarian medicine and how we take care of our furry, feathered, thin, and sometimes scaled friends. So it's going to be a great tale tonight. So everybody hang tight. We'll come back right after this commercial break. You're listening to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio.
You know the expression, cats have nine lives. Well, what if you can give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying or neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Joining me now is veterinarian and author Philip Schott. And we're talking to him about his latest book, Heal the Beasts. Philip, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're super excited about it. And the book is fascinating, to say the least. And I love the subtitle, A Jaunt Through the Curious History of the Veterinarian Arts. So it's more than a history. It's sort of a walk through the park, interesting techniques and things going on in veterinary medicine. So tell us a little bit about the book and how it came to be.
Yeah. So, you know, that subtitle you point out, each of those words is deliberate. So a jaunt, it's a light take, as light as the subject matter permits, right? So there's some things that are just not light about hill animals. But I want to be accessible. There's nothing on the market anywhere in the English-speaking world that addresses the history of veterinary medicine for the general reader. There's some academic works, but I want this to be the general, open and inviting to the general reader. The curious history, it's bizarre. Like, there are strange, amusing, interesting, fascinating things. Even me as a veterinarian and as somebody who's also passionate about history, I just, in researching it, it was just one thing after another that I unearthed. I thought, wow, that's incredible. So a jaunt, and it's curious, and it's the veterinary arts. So it's a science, of course, modern veterinary medicine, but it was much more an art in the past. There's still a little bit of art to it if you do it right, right? It's not just the cold science. It's the art and the science, but there's some, over the years, there's mostly the arts, to be honest, which is not always, again, such a bad thing. So, yeah, I came to write it because I saw that there wasn't anything out there like that. And as I said, veterinarian, 35 years, obviously passionate about that. Otherwise, yeah, I would have stuck with it for 35 years. And passionate about history. And it was an opportunity for those two streams to meet. I never thought I'd combine those two passions. And so there we are.
Right, right. Yeah, now it's the there's so many fascinating takes within the books. You're absolutely right. Obviously, you've done your research that a lot of times when we're talking about, you know, veterinary medicine and reading books and things about it, it's either, you know, it's very analytical for us common folks, very scientific minded for us, or we're talking about a particular topic, you know, a book about cancer, for instance. And that's very important. But the fascinating thing I loved about the book is, you know, how do we get to where we are today? And then sort of, you know, getting the reader to think a little bit about where are we going? Because I even reflect back. I mean, I've had animals all my life. And I remember those early days not knowing what to do. And even going to my veterinarian, it was, you know, for domestic animals, it was the basics. You know, it was a shot here or there, or a pill here or there. And even some of those medications and treatments are still around today, tried and true. But then looking back on it now, years later, totally different from everything from nutrition to animals to how we treat them and what we treat them for. And some of the things that we treat them, ways we treat them in the past were, seem really prehistoric, I'll say, at times.
No, absolutely. In my career, I've seen an enormous change. Obviously, the technology rapidly closing the gap with human medicine. And in fact, in some cases, maybe surpassing what's done in humans just because of, we're a little more nimble. We can do things a little faster. The approval process is quicker. So there's that. But more to the point of the book, our relationship to animals has changed in my time. You know, in the 1990s, it was still the case, at least up here, that if people refer to themselves as the dog's or cat's mom or dad, it was with a little bit of an ironic flair, right? A little tongue-in-cheek, a little chuckle. Now it's absolutely straight-faced. This is how they feel, right? This is the normal language. And then that tells us something about, you know, how pets have moved into the family in a very central way. And that was the case historically. We think that we're really advanced. We are in some ways, but if you go far enough back, you skip past the Industrial Revolution, go further back, go to early medieval Europe, you find, you know, peasants are living with their livestock, right? So their cattle, for sure, the cow is their livelihood, but they have to have a really strong bond with that animal to depend so heavily on it and live so closely with it. You go to pagan times then, and people had a spiritual connection with their animals in a way that we have, as modern kind of Westerners, that seems kind of weird to us in a way, but I see it coming back as well, so in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Eastern traditions and the philosophies are slowly but surely getting into that. And our animals obviously play a key part in our whole spirituality. And I did enjoy that fact that, you know, oftentimes you thought back before the Industrial Revolution and where you needed your beasts, we'll say, according to the book, to as your livelihood, you had to keep them happy and healthy and, well, not happy, but you had to keep them healthy as long as you could. Because you can't just go out and, you know, get another ox, or you couldn't get another plow horse or whatever it may be that you need to do. And now it's more of a combination of, you have a working animal, you've got to keep them healthy, but it's also you're looking for their happiness and, you know, doing different techniques that, you know, massaging your horse, these type of things, or your cow, you wouldn't have thought of before, you know, doing a little bit of comfort for your goat, because then it will produce more milk, these type of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's moving more to the forefront. It was always there, but people felt a little self-conscious about expressing those sorts of feelings and ideas.
Right. So doing the research on the book and going back through history, was there a threshold you originally set? You said, okay, I'm just going to do Industrial Revolution on. And then as you dug into it, it's like, well, I got to get some, you know, it keeps going back and then back and thousands of years into this. Did you originally come into this with the idea of, okay, I'll treat it from a certain multi-decades standpoint, or was it, you're wide open to anything that was fascinating and interesting?
Yeah, no, I was super ambitious. I wanted to do it all. And in fact, part of it was driven by the fact that one of the very first things I encountered is the first story in there. So the structure of the book, there's 22 chapters. Each one features a historical veterinarian or animal healer. Most of them real people. Some of them, if you go far back enough, we don't know who the individual was. So I make someone up. And there's a little story, like a fictionalized vignette, but plausible fiction that leads the reader into that chapter. So the first one is 12,000 BC in prehistoric Rhine Valley in what's now Germany. Archaeologists found two humans, man and a woman, and a puppy buried together. And not just random bones jumbled together, but clearly they were buried on purpose and in a ritual fashion. It was clear this was deliberate. Moreover, we know from the teeth of the puppy that it had several bouts of distemper. So distemper affects the enamel in a very characteristic way. So we know this puppy lived with distemper for a little while. And I can tell you, with all my modern veterinary technology and medicine, distemper, full-blown distemper, is really challenging to get them to survive. It's a really serious disease. So this puppy survived a little while. So it was getting some kind of care, number one. Number two, they buried this puppy with them.
Right.
You know, people in those days, they buried grave goods that they thought would be useful in the afterlife, you know, favorite sword or whatever.
Right.
A sick puppy, not useful in the afterlife, I'm thinking. So there must have been a bond of affection there, as well as this evidence that there was some kind of treatment, you know, herbal, whatever it was that they remembered. People were smart as we are 14,000 years ago, but they didn't have all the 100 distractions that we have. They didn't have to figure out how to pay their taxes or where the gas was the cheapest or all that kind of stuff. They just had to focus on the things immediately in front of them. So they could be very smart about that. So that led it off. And if I'm going to start at 12,000 BC, 14,000 years ago, then I'm going to go all the way through, right?
You could have easily had like four novels out of this for sure.
Yeah, and I didn't want to load it up with too much, again, technical mumbo jumbo. So I tried to keep things moving fairly briskly. So we'd jump ahead by hundreds, thousands of years in some cases, try to hit the highlights along the way.
Right. And I love the fact of that part of it, how you structured the book, because as we said from the get-go, it could have very easily been very scientific, or even I can imagine, I'm not a veterinarian, nor have I played one on TV, but I can imagine the fascination behind it, because you're in that story, the first story right off the get-go is, okay, so they buried their puppy. We know they had distemper, but what did they treat? How did they treat that? You know, it'd been very easy to dig into that, which is still fascinating. I would love to know what herb they used back then.
Who knows? Yeah.
You know, that we could use today possibly, or maybe it is still used today. You never know.
Maybe in some form. Yeah.
But yet you kept it more of a sort of, it's historical, it's factual based on what we know, but it's a storyline, you know, and each one of them holds true. You know, you can go from one to the other and pick up a nice, interesting, intriguing historical story without it being too deep, we'll say.
I hope so. Yeah. And a man is a storytelling animal, right? This is how we communicate. This is the most, in my mind, the most effective way of communicating is with stories.
Yeah. Absolutely. So if you had to go back and look through it all, is there a one that sort of gave you an aha, or you thought, oh man, I love this, or, you know, oh, the readers are going to love this particular one?
Yeah. Yeah. That's my favorite favorite child question that I can't always put any book that I've written. Yeah. So, you know, the one that jumps to mind, just because it's kind of funny in a way, and it kind of piques my sense of humor, is the in England, and what we used to call the Dark Ages, the early medieval period after the Romans left, so year 600, 700, around there, the farmers would be turning up as they're plowing the fields, and better plows could plow a little deeper, and they were turning up little stone arrowheads. And they had no idea of any sense of history that there had been peoples there thousands of years ago that might have had stone arrowheads. They thought it was invisible elves, and they blamed the invisible elves for their livestock being ill. So when the horse was ill or the cat was ill, they'd say, ah, it's been elf shot. That was the term in Old English that they used. It had been elf shot. We must get in the cow leech or the horse leech, because the veterinarian was the leech.
Right, right.
So dog leech for dogs, horse leech for horse, cow leech for cows. Apparently they were specialized that way. And he would come around and say, ah, you know, Mr. Horse leech, my horse has been elf shot. So he would go through this ritual. It was quite this elaborate thing. He had a special knife that had to have, the handle had to be from the horn of a cow that had never given birth to a calf. It had to be affixed with three brass nails, the metal part, the cutting part of the knife to the handle. And then he had to write the name of Christ, the Christian at that time, on the side of the animal, but not scratch it. It was invisible, but the elves could see it and they would run away in terror. And then he would be able to heal the animal through some more mumbo jumbo. And then you have to get a special stick. The farmer would be put to work to go get the special stick, go find a stick. And oh, is this the right stick? Cool. Smack the animal on the hind end and presto, it would get better or it wouldn't. So these guys were itinerant. They didn't have a fixed clinic. So they go from village to village. There's no internet. There's no five-star reputation or anything like that to uphold. They would just disappear. So I think they often gave practical advice too. You know, if the animal was bloated, they'd say, oh, by the way, you might want to take them off the fresh grass or something like that.
Right. And, right. But you know, it is fascinating when you go back through that, you know, and we sort of get a good chuckle out of, oh my God, these people, what were they thinking? You know, but that was the norm. That was the way you treated them, you know. And I don't know for sure. I'm not going to knock veterinary medicine because I love veterinarians all over and I've got plenty of them that I pay for. But that being said, can you imagine, you know, 10 years, 100 years from now, some of the things we're doing, and they look back and they think, what were these folks thinking? Or perhaps they uncover something that says, you know, that we can't explain it, but that worked in the olden days. So perhaps we need to brush that up a little bit.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's always an arrogance with modernity, however you define it. They were, you know, in the 1890s, they thought they were the cat's pajamas. They had steam, my God. So you will always think that we're at some kind of, you know, kind of apogee, but it's ever, you know, it's ever evolving, right? It's ever moving forward. And for sure, there's stuff, like there's some really odd things in medicine and veterinary medicine that we can't properly explain right now, that I'm sure they'll be like, if I live long enough, I'll have like forehead smacking moments down the road. Like, how did we miss that?
Or yeah.
How did we not understand that?
Exactly.
And you're right. Like some old treatments, they come back. I mean, I've been in practice long enough to see things come full circle. Stuff that we did in the early 90s that then was poo-pooed in the early 2000s. Well, it's back now.
And so, exactly.
So that happens as well. Some of it is cyclical that way.
That's the fascinating thing about it, is uncovering those old gems, those old remedies, the Granny Clampett elixir, if you know that reference from the Beverly Hillbillies. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But some of those things work, so I don't know. So that's interesting.
And some of it is just logical. There's a story in there about a kid, just a little brief thing about canaries, that canaries were popular pets in the early 1800s. And they would get this wind disease. It's basically air sac disease. The air sacs would swell up and burst, and then they'd get subcutaneous emphysema. So they'd get air under their skin. They'd be bloated. Well, you stick a pin in it, actually. And that's all you do, and let the air out. And, you know, you got to hold on to it so it doesn't take off.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Just sterilize a pin and stick a pin in. And yeah, that's pretty much what we would do today too. With
That's right. But it has to be a special pin with a special feather
exactly.
on the end. And yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break. Then we'll come back and talk to Dr. Philip Schott about his book, Heal the Beasts, and pick his brain a little bit more about writing styles, because obviously this is not the first, and I'm sure it won't be the last. So we want to hear from the experts. So everybody, hang tight. We'll get back right after this commercial break. You're listening to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio.
Begging to hear more of your favorite show? Full episodes of all our shows are available on demand. Go to PetLifeRadio.com to fetch our entire lineup of Possum Pet Podcasts. Also, dig us up in iHeartRadio and iTunes. Let's talk pets. Live and on demand, only from Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Continue our conversation with Philip Schott, DVM, and author extraordinaire, and his latest book, Heal the Beasts, A Jaunt Through the Curious History of the Veterinarian Arts. So, Philip, after writing a book, putting it together, is there a certain message or something you're looking for when the reader reads through it? Did you have an original goal of what you hope they gain from it? And did that change from when you first started writing it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, some of it was just to open up this world to people. I think what veterinarians do sometimes, there's a certain, people have an image, they have an idea, and I want to pull the curtain back. That's my first book a number of years ago, The Accidental Veterinarian, was all about that, just on modern practice. Pull the curtain back. This is what it's actually all about. Pull the curtain back on this history. But the message is about the human-animal bond and how it's been forever, and it's changed somewhat, you know. So really, there are three reasons, two primary and then a secondary reason for people to treat animals. One is emotional, because we have a bond with them. And that, as I, you know, as we talked about in the last segment, that was right there from prehistoric times. We have good evidence of that. Second is practical, right? So, you know, these are sources of meat, sources of eggs, milk, sources of power for, you know, plowing and that sort of thing back in the day. And then the third one we touched on is spiritual. You may view the animal as a relative in a way, right? So if you believe in reincarnation or those sorts of spiritual connections. I'd talk a little bit, just a couple pages, about the idea of familiars in the Middle Ages, you know, how with witchcraft. There was this idea of a familiar, this has this evil connotations, but it was actually considered largely a positive thing that people would have that kind of connection with an animal. So I wanted people to think about that, or these reasons, these bonds that we've had with animals, and that it's all cultures. It's throughout the world. It's not just a Western thing. It's not a modern thing. It's a human thing, you know, from the Inuit to the Australian Aborigines and everybody in between, and from prehistory to right today.
Nice. I love that. I love that tagline. I want to steal that one from you for sure. It's a human thing. And it's absolutely true. You know, we try to pigeonhole how we do things here in North America compared to how we're doing them in, you know, Eastern cultures, these type of things. And what I see is a lot of blending of what's going on. A lot of, you know, as we become a more blended society, we learn from this. We learn how to treat the animals, and we learn, you know, different methods of not only treating them physically, but emotionally and from a spiritual standpoint. And I love that aspect. I've always been open to, I'm a very spiritual person, and obviously deal a lot, know that animals are spiritual beings, but learning from other cultures and how they go about doing things has always been fascinating to me. And I think you did a great job in the book here, because it brings up these different aspects, you know, and I think there are people that will read the book and say, oh wow, I didn't know, I wasn't expecting to talk about, the relationship and the spirituality and how that blends into what we talk about. Veterinary medicine.
Yes, thank you.
So the writing side of things, I got to pick your brain about that. Are you the up at 5:30 every morning to write 5,000 words a day type writer? Or are you like me and I've got 1 week till deadline, I got to throw something out there?
Yeah, more of the former than the latter. The rest of my family's the latter. They're all kind of deadline-driven people. Now, I'm a bit of an ethnic cliche. I'm a German-Canadian. And the Germans were very organized. I set a word target and I hit it. I just do it. I just sit down and I do it. And the basic advice is always just write and then edit afterwards. Don't pre-decide what's garbage and what isn't. Just get it out there and then go back and get rid of the garbage. But yeah, and I'm a morning person, so I do write, not necessarily 5:30. That's when I'm out walking my dog. but the writing is in the morning. That's when I'm most productive. I'm still part-time in practice, so blending those two things is can be tricky. But I in 2015, I just very deliberately, again, very German, I turned 50 in 2015, and my 50th birthday present to myself was to take a day off a week to write. And that's nice. When I started writing, and that's when I started as a blog, and the blog became the first book, and then it kind of evolved from there.
How about you? I love that. I love that. Give yourself a gift, and a gift of a day. In your case, it's for writing, but for me, it's, and it could be more than napping, and definitely walking the dog multiple times. That's always good. Well, I love that. Well, as far as the structure is concerned, do you do a whiteboard or a computer outline to get an idea of what you're doing? Or is it more of, here's my topic, I'm going to delve into it, and then sort of sort through it to see what sticks after that?
Yeah, I kind of write straight kind of from the head or from the heart. I don't, you would think that I'm very organized, I've got lots of lists and so on. But when it comes to writing, I just write. And, I think I pre-write. I know I pre-write in my head. So I do a lot of walking in the winter, cross-country skiing and so on. And that's not an earbuds kind of person. I'm just in my head then. So I'm just thinking, and that it comes then, and then I get it out on paper. So yeah, it's not even, and the books have all been different. I've written a novel, some memoirs, write a whole mystery series with a veterinarian as the protagonist. And there I really should storyboard that, because boy, I get myself into trouble. But 3/4 of the way through, thinking, oh no, I've left all these loose threads. I'm going to try and pick them up and tie them up somehow. It helps to have a good editor. Yeah. Xavier Bacon, I tell you.
Well, it's always good to know who you killed off last time, and make sure it's not a fan favorite. You never want to kill off the fan favorite, and never the animal. The dogs always live throughout the story.
No. I learned the first mystery book was 57 Pigs. It was called, it's an explosion in a swine barn that, and there's a human body hidden in there. And so anyway, all the pigs died, like on the first page, and people were really not happy.
How could you kill out the pigs when they're in the title? What's going on here?
Exactly. I learned my lesson.
That's fascinating.
No other animals die in any of my books.
I love that. I love that. And I love the fact that I talk a lot about it, in public, and I've written about it, and with my clients, I talk a lot about this thing called meditation. And to me, meditation is anything that allows your conscious mind to shut off, allows your subconscious to open up. And so oftentimes with meditation, you know, we think of formal mantras, guided. I mean, I've got professionally recorded guided meditation albums out there if you want to buy one. But if that's what gets you to that state, then that's great. But meditation is those walks in nature, doing the cross-country skiing, the things that allows you to forget about life, opens up those channels and allows that to flow. And I love how you do that for yourself, and then you turn that into manifesting a, you know, a great book and in multiple different genres. So kudos to you. Learned a lot. We're going to put you up on the on my own personal storyboard. Say, hey, look what this guy's doing. It's what I've been talking about all these years.
Yeah, well, I do meditate as well, although, you know, a pretty light formal practice, kind of like flossing. I remember to do it.
I've had the pleasure of going through deep meditations with the Tibetan monks, and
nice, okay.
Yeah, which was fantastic experience. But you know, their meditations last for hours, if not days. And
Man, that's something else.
Being a human, I got about an hour into it, and I'm like, okay, my butt is numb. I can't do this anymore. But it was a great experience,
no doubt.
But meditation, yeah, it's just stealing some time, and it doesn't have to be at a set time every day, though you can do that, and it doesn't have to be hours upon end. It could be 5 minutes here or there, and I love how you channel that opportunity. So tell us a little bit about where people can find out where to get the book, and where they can find out about your activities, all your writings, and keep up on what is happening in your world.
Yeah, I'm a modern person. I am on social media. I'm pretty open. My email address is easy to find. So, and my name, my spelling is relatively unique. There's two or three other people with my spelling in Germany. You won't confuse them. They're, one of them's like a physics prof and another's a photographer. So yeah, philipschott.com, you can find me there, or my publisher in Toronto, ecwpress.com. They've got all my books listed, and I'm, again, modern person, it's on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, I know, carries them over here. Chapters, Indigo carries them. There's ebook, all of them come in ebook and audiobook format, you know, and you often, that's great for the mysteries, you know, for Heal the Beasts, I would kind of recommend the hard copy, because it's actually my first book that has a photographic insert. So there's, I don't know, maybe 20 pages of illustrations in the middle. And I'm quite proud of the illustrations. I've right from Egyptian tombs on up to modern Uganda. I've got pictures in there that illustrate the book. So.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. Well, everybody pick up a copy of the book, Heal the Beasts, A Jaunt Through the Curious History of the Veterinarian Arts by Philip Schott, DVM. Philip, thank you so much for coming on the show. Congratulations on the book. It's a fantastic read, very insightful, interesting, and it confirms a lot of what I know and what I don't know about veterinary medicine and animals around us. So congratulations on all that.
No, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Well, we're coming to the end of the show today. I want to thank everyone for listening to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. I want to thank the producers and sponsors for making this show possible. If you want to drop us a line, ask to have your favorite authors on, or if you have any questions or comments, you can drop it at petliferadio.com. And we'll be glad to entertain your comments, answer your questions, and bring on the people you want to hear from most. And while you're there, check out all the other wonderful hosts and shows. It's a cornucopia of barking and meowing fun, put it that way. So until next time, write a great story about the animals in your life. And who knows, you may be the next guest on Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Everybody have a great day.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.